Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as, well, an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. There are a few men who bring more intelligence to bear more consistently and with greater effect than our first guest. He is an old friend and colleague, Ambassador John Bolton. He formerly represented the United States as the permanent representative of this country at the United Nations, capping a long and very important succession of posts he's had in the United States government, the Justice Department, as well as the State Department and U.S. Agency for International Development. Mr. Ambassador, welcome back. It is always a delight to have you with us.
Glad to be with you. Thanks for having me.
One of the things that is much in need of critical analysis at the moment, it seems to me, is the argument that the record and the judgment of Hillary Clinton make her the most qualified person in the history of this country to become our next commander-in-chief. You have been in this space for a long time. You've spent, in particular, as I mentioned, a considerable amount of time in the senior reaches of the State Department. I'd ask you for your objective analysis of that record and judgment, John Bolton.
Well, I think it's ridiculous to say that she, based on her record, would do an adequate job in protecting American national security. Now, I'm leaving aside whatever she has said in this campaign, whatever she may say in the next 3 months, because I do believe, following the example of her husband, she will say whatever it takes to get her elected. That's not the same as what she believes and what she's done. And in fact, looking at what she did during her 4 years as Secretary of State under Barack Obama, looking at what she said about it in her 600-page long memoir, which if there's ever a place to distance yourself from your boss, that's the time to do it, she would be, by all the objective evidence, Barack Obama's third term. And I think that's true, by the way, for domestic issues as well as international issues, but particularly on the national security side. That means that the deterioration of our security around the world is guaranteed to continue if she's elected. And I think arguing to the contrary just ignores reality.
And to the extent in particular that there are a few Bill's particular items here that we might serve up as evidence to the American people of where she's gotten things wrong. Would you talk a little bit about Russia, the Muslim Brotherhood, and the whole notion that suppressing freedom of speech is something that we can, you know, embrace as a nation?
Yeah. Well, look, she is the author of the famous reset button on Russia, and it was a policy that she pushed and was critical to implementing while she was at the State Department, and it was all based on the perception that we could have a wonderful relationship with Russia if only the policies of the Bush administration could be reversed. And so they set about reversing a lot of those policies, giving away key assets for our national missile defense, and by that, as you and I know, we mean defending the homeland, defending Americans from the threat of ballistic missiles carrying nuclear warheads from North Korea, Iran, or other rogue states. She's the one that led the negotiations for the New START arms control treaty with Moscow, which was a wholesale surrender of American interest. She's the one that excused Russia flying cover for Iran and North Korea in the UN Security Council and more broadly. She got, as did her boss, Barack Obama, virtually everything wrong on the subject of how to deal with Russia. And on the threat of international terrorism, radical Islam, and the mortal threat it poses to the United States, her view is precisely the same as Obama's. It's not a war. It's a law enforcement matter. It's a reversion to the policy of her husband for 8 years that allowed al-Qaeda and others to do the preparations that led to 9/11 and subsequent terrorist attacks. And in the United Nations, while she was Secretary of State, we watched the continued erosion in the international organization environment of the ability to criticize radical Islam for exactly what it was, and the continued support for terrorism that we saw in the UN because of its inability to do anything effective to stop international terrorism that she went essentially right along with. So those are two important issues. As you know, there are only two on a long list of her failures.
But those are
two good ones, that's for sure.
We're talking with John Bolton, the author of Surrender is Not an Option, Defending America at the United Nations and Abroad. And speaking of the United Nations, John, as you've been describing some of its checkered past, looking to the future, there are two things that I wanted to ask you about. One is what you think is the likely upshot of the selection process for the next Secretary General of the United Nations, point one, and point two, this reputed effort of President Obama to bring to the United Nations Security Council some sort of resolution that would essentially bypass the Senate with respect to an internationally binding commitment not to ever engage in nuclear testing again.
Well, I'm very worried by what the administration may do in the selection of a UN Secretary General, and this is a decision that can have a real impact on the United States during the five-year term of whomever is ultimately elected. I think the best you can do is find somebody who's content to be what the UN Charter calls for, which is simply a person who will be the chief administrative officer of the United Nations. What we don't want is somebody who thinks they're there to save the world and sees themselves as being above the member states. That was the risk with Kofi Annan, and I think that's something we want to avoid. I'm very worried, given all the reasons that we've discussed over the years, that Obama's view of the United Nations is significantly more expansive than that. And I think you can see it playing out in the second part of your question. This draft resolution, which members of Congress and their staffs have been briefed on, is something the administration's looking at, that ignores the fact that back in the 1990s, the Comprehensive Test Ban Treaty was not only not approved by the Senate, it was actually defeated by a majority vote, something almost unprecedented in our history, and they're going to try and bring it back somehow. Now, the only good news here is that they cannot do this constitutionally, not that that slowed the Obama administration down before. I think this should be an election issue. It's part of the overarching problem of Obama just doing what he wants to do, statutes, constitutions, you know, minor problems like that notwithstanding. So it has both, I think, domestic ramifications as well as international ramifications. I think if the American people properly understood it, they'd reject what Obama's trying to do overwhelmingly.
Well, as they tried to do with respect to another of his end runs on the constitutional process, as you know so well because you were very active in opposing it, namely the Iran deal, so-called. John Bolton, we've had roughly a year of it. What is your assessment of this accord with one of the most dangerous countries on the planet? Has it prevented them from pursuing a nuclear weapon, and what else has flowed from it?
Yeah, it hasn't slowed them down on the nuclear front at all, as was entirely predictable, and indeed people were predicting it. Iran has not shifted its international conduct one iota. If anything, it's gotten worse, taking more hostages despite a cash for hostage element of the deal that clearly was part of the overall negotiations. Look, we've given Iran everything it sought in the negotiations and more. They made trivial, incidental concessions on the nuclear front that they're already repudiating and trying to renegotiate. They've done nothing. In fact, they've accelerated their ballistic missile program, and I have no doubt have been violating the nuclear provisions of the Vienna deal since before the ink was dry. This was a diplomatic Waterloo for the United States. Nothing we've learned in the past year has made it look any better, and I think you can guarantee under Hillary Clinton, every effort to save the deal mentality that we see from Obama and Kerry will continue. It's true that The deal was signed 3 years after Hillary left the State Department, but the foundation was laid while she was there. And if it had been humanly possible to cut the deal while she was there, she would have done it. Make no mistake about it.
Yeah, and I figure worse is yet to come should she, in fact, become the Commander-in-Chief of the United States. John Bolton, we appreciate your past service to our country that you're rendering these days at the American Enterprise Institute and in the various Bolton PACs and super PACs, and appreciate, as always, your time with us. Come back to us again, if you would, very soon. Frank Calzone joins us. We'll talk about another fiasco, Cuba, American policy that is hurting human rights there. Straight ahead.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney.
Over the past decade, while the American military and intelligence community have been engaged in a kinetic war overseas against a wide array of enemies aligned with the global jihadist movement, the Center for Security Policy has consistently shed light upon a dark and subversive effort that thrives nearly unopposed right here in this country, the one known by the Muslim Brotherhood as Civilization Jihad. In an effort to educate freedom-loving Americans about Civilization Jihad and how it has been waged against every facet of American civilization, the Center for Security Policy has, in 2015, begun publishing a series of monographs called the Civilization Jihad Reader Series. The first of these monographs is entitled Sharia in American Courts, and it documents how Sharia, divine Islamic law, which animates the global jihadist movement, has entered our very own court system. In this study, the Center documents how parties to litigation in American appellate courts have attempted to use Sharia to resolve 146 cases in 32 different states, potentially threatening the constitutional rights of our citizens, particularly women and children. The monograph not only highlights these cases, but the organizations here in America that are actively and successfully working to insinuate Sharia into our judiciary. Finally, it provides information on at least one antidote to this infirmity, a law that has been adopted in 8 states, one that protects our citizens against the use of foreign law and upholds our Constitution as the supreme law of the land, lest those who fight to defend our Constitution overseas do not come home to see it subordinated in a courtroom in their own home state. Learn more by reading Sharia in American Courts, which can be found on Amazon.com or the Center for Security Policy's website at www.securefreedom.org.
Hi, this is Frank Gaffney. My day job is running the Center for Security Policy, which each weeknight brings you this program. But Secure Freedom Radio is just one of the important contributions the Center makes to the common defense. We call our team the Special Forces in the War of Ideas. Like the real Special Forces, we strive to be agile, creative, and highly effective in identifying threats to our country and how they might best be countered. We can't do all this without you, though. Also, like the real Special Forces, ours need ammunition. And in the war of ideas, ammo is money. The Center is a nonprofit, tax-exempt organization. Contributions to its work are tax-deductible and an important investment in your security and freedom. Find out more about the Center for Security Policy and how you can help keep its Special Forces team in the fight by visiting securefreedom.org. Many thanks.
I'm Jared Ogden, former Navy SEAL and member of Team Military on National Geographic Channel's Ultimate Survival Alaska. I want to tell you about an issue that you probably haven't heard much about. Thousands of America's veterans are suffering from occupational and environmental exposures that they were exposed to while serving in the military. We call these the toxic wounds of war. From Agent Orange and Gulf War illness to post-9/11 burn pit exposure and heavy metals in the air, and other toxic exposures that we don't fully understand. The Sergeant Sullivan Center is a powerful voice in our nation's capital, standing watch over these forgotten wounded. These men and women can't do it alone, and they need your help today. Every dollar raised by Sergeant Sullivan Center goes to medical research, public awareness, and advocacy. You can make a tax-deductible donation today at www.sergeantsullivancenter.org. That's SGTSullivanCenter.org.
This is Frank Effney. You're listening to AM 1260, The Answer.
You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
Welcome back. I'm very pleased to say we're joined by one of our duty experts on Cuba and what is happening there in part as a result of President Obama's policies. He is Frank Calzone, the executive director of a very important organization in Washington, D.C., the Center for a Free Cuba. He has been an activist and leader in this space for many years, including for quite some time as a Washington representative for Freedom House. And Frank, it's always good to talk with you, but this is especially timely as over the weekend, Fidel Castro celebrated his 90th birthday. And you might just share with us a quip that goes around in Cuba about the old man.
Well, the Cubans, of course, are still very unhappy with the Castro's revolution, not only with Fidel, but also with his brother Raul, who happens to be president of Cuba. And the only reason he's Raul is president is that Fidel happens to be the brother of Fidel.
Listen, speaking of the devil, the president of the United States has made a deal with the devil, I think it's fair to say. And one of the justifications for abandoning American policy of many decades standing was that by opening up relations with the Castro regime, the United States would help those who seek to transform Cuba, specifically by improving the lot in life of its people and their human rights. How has this been going in the year or so that this experiment has been underway, Frank Calzone?
Well, the secret dealings with Havana, just like the secret dealings with Iran, have a lot to do with the so-called narrative, the wishes of the president, but have hardly anything to do with reality. The Cuban government has increased substantially its repression of the Cuban people. There's a group of women who go to mass every week, and they're beat up, and they're dragged, and they're thrown in prison. The amount of repression in Cuba has increased to a degree that, as we speak, there are several dissidents who are in a hunger strike, urging the international community to call on the Cuban government to stop the beating of peaceful dissidents, especially the women in Cuba.
And to the extent that this is not working out, is there any sign that the Obama administration is rethinking its position or at least taking up with the Castro regime the plight of the dissidents and for that matter, the population of Cuba more generally?
Well, I think it's fair to say that the White House, the president, President Obama, has only taken up with any energy with Raul Castro issues that Raul Castro wants to talk about and issues that benefit the Cuban government. For example, the Cuban government wanted a number of spies returned to Cuba that were serving in American prisons. One of these spies was sentenced to a life sentence for his participation in the planning of the murder by Cuban warplanes of Americans in the Florida Straits. Well, those folks, those spies were returned to Raul Castro. But the American terrorists who live in Cuba, one of whom killed a New Jersey state trooper and was sentenced to life in prison and then escaped, the administration has made any announcement after all this time of any effort to get those folks to be brought to justice in America.
When you look at what is happening to specifically these dissidents, and I see that Senator Ted Cruz had a rather forceful statement on their behalf in the Miami Herald the other day. Frank Calzone, what would you have the government of the United States do? And why is this important not just to the people of Cuba, but to us here in the United States as well?
Well, the traditional foreign policy of the United States is predicated on the idea that American efforts would advance American interests or protect American interests. To help the Castro government by providing them unlimited or millions and millions of resources just like the Obama administration is doing with Iran, doesn't help American interests. Furthermore, Senator Cruz raises the other dimension of the Castro dictatorship, which has to do with foreign policy. Now, under President Obama, Russian spy ships come to Havana on a regular basis. Mr. Obama says that the Cold War is over, but as far as Havana and Russia, the Cold War is not over, and Havana is playing, again, an important part in helping North Korea by sending them weapons, again, providing safe havens in Cuba for terrorists. The American interests have to be put on the table. And we hope that the American people will call on the president, one, to speak out forcefully, telling Raul Castro, General, you have to stop beating up women. It doesn't make any sense for thousands of American tourists to go to Cuba as if everything was normal, while Cuban women who go out to church with a flower in their hand get beat up by the police.
It certainly doesn't. And those ladies in white, as they call themselves, are really exemplars of courage that week after week after week, they go forth in their protests, peaceful protests, facing the certainty that they will be beaten at best and at worst carted off to jail. And the fact that the United States isn't doing more, at least to hold them up as exemplars of what we hope Cuba will become, is a scandal, quite frankly. Equally scandalous, in fact, in some ways many times more scandalous, is that we're turning a blind eye to what you've helped document at the Center for a Free Cuba, Frank Calzone, and that is the extent to which the Cuban military is benefiting from the normalization. Talk, if you would, a bit about that, please.
Well, the Cuban tourist industry is fully controlled by the military. The hotels, the transportation for tourists inside the country is run by the military. Other commercial enterprises, if they're not run by the military, are run by the family, by the son-in-law, or by other relatives of the Castro brothers.
Frank Calzone, in addition to helping the Cuban military, which controls the tourism industry, is there a possibility that Americans visiting Cuba might be exposing themselves to the Zika virus?
There is something in the newspapers in South Florida, and the problem with it that is propagated by mosquitoes. Well, if you look at the map in the Caribbean, there are epidemics like that in many places. Havana usually tries to kick under the rug any information on such things because they don't want foreigners or tourists to be afraid about what is happening in Cuba. I just saw a couple of days ago photographs that I'll be sending you of piles of garbage in many streets in central Havana that are not being picked up. And that's hardly encouraging when you have a problem with mosquitoes in a tropical situation like Cuba, and we're now in the middle of the very hot summer.
So your warning is that before people head off to Cuba for vacation and tourism, they should be thinking about the fact that the principal beneficiary will be an enemy of the United States, the Cuban military, and secondly, they may be putting themselves at considerable risk as well due to health problems there. If we are out of time, I'm afraid we've got to go. I appreciate so much your insights and the work that you do at the Center for a Free Cuba. Keep it up, my friend. Come back to us again very soon. Next up, Dr. Norm Bailey on the strategy that won the Cold War and that we need to apply today. That and more straight ahead.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney.
America's injured and critically ill service members face incredible challenges every day of their lives. Since 2004, the Semper Fi Fund has helped thousands of service members and their families with both immediate and long-term needs. Join the Semper Fi Fund in supporting American heroes. Learn how your tax-deductible donation makes a real difference in their lives at SemperFiFund.org.
This is Frank Gaffney with the Secure Freedom Minute. In his last days in office, President Obama reportedly wants to get the UN's Security Council to endorse a ban on underground nuclear testing. It would be a twofer for Mr. Obama. First, he evidently hopes to encumber his successor from taking steps needed to modernize America's deterrent. And second, he intends once again to undermine the Constitution with its requirement that the U.S. Senate advise and consent to treaties like the Comprehensive Test Ban. But the Senate voted to reject that treaty 17 years ago for good reason. And today's Washington Free Beacon describes multi-billion-dollar investments the Kremlin is making in preparing for nuclear war by both comprehensively upgrading Russia's arsenal and the underground bunkers from which its use would be directed. We need a national debate about how best to end our unilateral nuclear disarmament, not more of it. This is Frank Gaffney.
Many sounds in your daily life. Ones that make you smile. Ones that help you relax. And there are some sounds that can help save lives. Wireless emergency alerts. Now on many mobile devices, use a unique sound and vibration to bring you critical information about emergencies in your area. With updates from local sources you know and trust, you can be in the know wherever you are. Learn more at ready.gov/alerts. Brought to you by FEMA and the Ad Council.
Secure Freedom announces the launch of our newest initiative, the Counter Jihad Campaign at counterjihad.com. We have gathered some of the foremost experts and activists to begin our fight back against those who long ago declared war on us. You can see our first two ads asking those who see something bad happening, like the attack in Garland, Texas, or the dozen jihadists at the Boston Marathon Killers Mosque, to say something. Join us and be a part of the Counter Jihad.
When we decided to rename this radio station, we came up with one word, one very big word, answer. That's because we know our listeners better than anybody. We know you wake up every day with an insatiable appetite for news and information. But more than that, you want to know what to make of it all. That's why we're here. We do this better than any station in town. Welcome aboard. AM 1260, The Answer.
This is Fred Fleitz with the Center for Security Policy. Now that the June 30th deadline for a nuclear agreement with Iran has passed, Secretary of State John Kerry is in Vienna struggling to finalize an agreement. Listeners to this program know that the nuclear talks are deeply flawed and a bad deal is preordained. We now know one reason for this bad deal is because the Rockefeller Foundation spent millions to back a loose coalition of peace groups, think tanks, and former U.S. officials to push for a nuclear agreement with Iran. This included freelance diplomacy with Iranian officials over the past 10 years. In addition, a core member of this effort is former CIA official Paul Pillar, who wrote a 2012 article titled, "We Can Live with a Nuclear Iran." This explains why a bad deal with Iran will emerge from the nuclear talks. This is another reason why Congress must kill this deal. I'm Fred Fleitz. Learn more at our new website on the Iran Talks, irantruth.org.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
We're back. I'm very pleased to say, joined by a colleague and friend of many years, Dr. Norman Bailey. He is the co-author of a book about which he knows quite a bit, The Grand Strategy That Won the Cold War, Architecture of Triumph. Norm, as I say, had considerable experience with all of this and a hand in that grand strategy as the director, senior director of international economic affairs at the White House National Security Council during the presidency of Ronald Reagan, the heyday, I might say, of that presidency early on. Norm Bailey, welcome. It's good to catch up with you. I know we're finding you in Israel these days, but it's very, very good of you to take some time to talk with us.
Thank you. It's a pleasure.
So, Norm, if you would, talk a little bit about that strategy that you helped President Reagan craft. What defined it, and how did he go about executing it?
Well, what I call World War III, which was commonly referred to as the Cold War, differed from World Wars I and II because in World Wars I and II, the military aspect of the overall strategic plans that the Allies had was absolutely predominant. In the Cold War, this was not the case. There were very important ideological, or if you prefer, propaganda aspects. There were important diplomatic aspects. There were very vitally important economic aspects. And certainly, subversion was a very important element, particularly subversion as practiced by the communist side in the Cold War. But all of these elements of a grand strategy had to be brought to bear when the Western world finally decided to go beyond the doctrine of containment, which was punctured by various periods of accommodation of the Soviet bloc, referred to as détente. And the Reagan administration came to office in 1981, and shortly after he was elected, President Reagan, at that time Governor Reagan, President-elect Reagan, was asked by an interviewer, Governor, what is your strategy, what is your policy with reference to the Cold War? And he said, we win, they lose. That was, of course, a complete changeover from the policies of containment on the one hand and détente on the other hand, and was, of course, considered by the literati of the Eastern foreign policy establishment as absolutely barbaric language, which shouldn't be allowed in polite company. At any rate, Dick Allen, who was the first national security advisor of President Reagan, put together a team headed by Richard Pipes to precisely put together a grand strategy including all these elements that I just mentioned: diplomacy, propaganda, economic strategies, subversion, military display, and if necessary, war, to win the Cold War. And that strategy was developed over a period of about 2 years, was adopted by the National Security Council, and was put into effect with incredible success. And despite the opposition of two of the great departments of government, namely the State Department and the Commerce Department. But aside from that, it had the enthusiastic support of all the rest of the government and certainly of the higher ranks of the Reagan administration.
Yeah, most importantly, the commitment of the president himself, which, needless to say, is a critical requirement. Norm Bailey is our guest, and he is the co-author of The Grand Strategy That Won the Cold War, Architecture of Triumph. And Norm, these were often seen in retrospect, the collapse, ultimately, of the Soviet Union and the demise, we were told, of Soviet communism as kind of inevitable, as something that happened, principally thanks to Mikhail Gorbachev, and that that was sort of inevitable because he was such a visionary leader. Give us your perspective on that sort of, rendering of the history of the time.
In the first few years after the Cold War ended and the Soviet Union collapsed, the general attitude of the academic and policy communities was that this was due to Gorbachev, that Gorbachev had taken power in the Soviet Union in order to lose the Cold War and collapse the Soviet Union. This is ridiculous on the face of it. I mean, of course he didn't take power in order to do that. He took power and tried to save the Soviet Union. And, of course, there were certain elements of reform that he put into place, glasnost and other elements, in order precisely to save the Soviet Union, to maintain its as one of the two superpowers of the world, and to forge ahead. He failed because the counter strategy, the grand strategy of the Reagan administration, made it essential that he fail. And a wonderful story, it's a true story, after the Reykjavik conference, when Gorbachev offered Reagan the sun, moon, and the stars if he would only stop the Strategic Defense Initiative. And contrary to the advice of just about everybody in his delegation, the president said no. And Gorbachev, we know this from internal records that have come to light since the end of the Cold War, Gorbachev went back to Moscow, convened the Central Committee of the Communist Party of the Soviet Union, and said, gentlemen, it's all over. The president has rejected our final offer and continues with his plans to defeat us.
You know, what's interesting to me, Norm, and you were very intimately involved in so much of this, and to your great and lasting credit, is that towards the end there, after Reykjavik, the Reagan administration under the increasing influence of George Shultz, Mike Deaver, Nancy Reagan, of course, seemed to make a fairly concerted effort to try to prop up Mikhail Gorbachev and to save the Soviet Union. Is that a mistake? Am I mistaken in perceiving that? That certainly seems to be the case in retrospect.
Well, it's both true and not true. It's true in the sense that the people you mentioned were trying to get him to do that. It's not true in the sense that he did not yield to them. He maintained his goals from day one to the day he left the Oval Office. Now, it's quite true that George H.W. Bush, when he became president, made a substantial effort to save the Soviet Union, and as well as Yugoslavia, which was also in the process of disintegrating. It was too late. It couldn't be done. But because George H.W. Bush was a perfect example of the East Coast foreign policy elite, it's not surprising that was what he tried to do, along with Howard Baker and other people in the administration.
Jim Baker, not least. Norm, very quickly, what are the insights and relevance of this grand strategy for our own time?
Well, what I call World War IV, which is the war against radical Islam, has got to be fought if it's going to be fought successfully, and right now it is not being fought successfully. In other words, the Western world is losing World War IV at this point by adopting a grand strategy similar to that which won the World War III, the Cold War. It cannot be won with military action alone. We're fighting against ideas. We're fighting for the hearts and minds of people. We're fighting an ideology, an extremely powerful ideology, a more powerful ideology because it's religiously based than either Nazism or communism in World War II and World War III. So we have to use all the elements of statecraft, from diplomacy, economic strategies, propaganda, which is extremely important, public diplomacy in this particular world war, subversion, and military display in war.
Thank you. Norm, we have to leave it at that, but this is an important beginning to a longer conversation I hope to have with you, because I think you couldn't be more right that a similar kind of strategy to that reflected in, National Security Decision Directive 75 comes to mind, that laid out this architecture for victory. We have to leave it at that, though. Norm, we'll talk to you again soon. Thank you very much for your time today and for your great service to our country over the years. Next up, we'll be speaking with Gordon Chang. Right after this.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
It's been over 7 years since a church group from another state brought a couple hundred refugees to the rural county where I live. I wanted to know, how could they do this? What was the governmental process that allowed the resettlement of refugees to a county ill-prepared to assimilate them? Employment opportunities were scarce. The health department was not familiar with illnesses and mental health problems of people who came from parts of the third world. The school system was not prepared to teach large numbers of students who didn't speak English.
That's author Ann Corcoran discussing her new book, Federal Immigration Policy, Resettlement and the Hijra to America. She explains how Muslim immigrants are being quietly resettled into American towns without vetting them, even for terrorist links. Corcoran also explains how the global jihad movement is using immigration as a stealth campaign to spread its influence in America. You can read Federal Immigration Policy, Resettlement, and the Hijra to America on securefreedom.org or purchase a copy on amazon.com.
Hi, this is Frank Gaffney. My day job is running the Center for Security Policy, which each weeknight brings you this program. But Secure Freedom Radio is just one of the important contributions the Center makes to the common defense. We call our team the Special Forces in the War of Ideas. Like the real Special Forces, we strive to be agile, creative, and highly effective in identifying threats to our country and how they might best be countered. We can't do all this without you, though. Also, like the real Special Forces, ours need ammunition. And in the War of Ideas, ammo is money.
The center is a nonprofit, tax-exempt organization. Contributions to its work are tax-deductible and an important investment in your security and freedom. Find out more about the Center for Security Policy and how you can help keep its Special Forces team in the fight by visiting securefreedom.org. Many thanks.
I'm Robert Muse, co-founder and senior counsel of the American Freedom Law Center, our nation's premier public interest law firm fighting for your faith and freedom in courtrooms across America. Make no mistake, we live in a pivotal time. Secular progressives such as Barack Obama and his surrogates are zealously sweeping religion from the public square, foisting Sharia law and other harmful international precedents into our courts and constitution, assaulting the traditional family, and weakening our national defense by, among other things, undermining the strength of our military through social engineering and political correctness. But I can assure you that the American Freedom Law Center is aggressively engaging our nation's enemies with offensive lawfare to defend our fundamental rights and to fight stealth jihad in all of its forms, including the civilization jihad being waged by Muslim Brotherhood front groups operating here in the U.S. Indeed, there is no other public interest law firm as uniquely qualified to fight this battle. But we need your prayers and financial support to succeed. Please consider a tax-deductible donation to support our critical fight for your faith and freedom. Visit us at www.AmericanFreedomLawCenter.org.
I'm Fred Fleitz with the Center for Security Policy. One of President Obama's worst foreign policy failings is the lack of a strategy to defeat Al-Qaeda and ISIS. These terrorist groups are part of a global movement to establish Islamic supremacy and Sharia through violence. This movement is called the Global Jihad Movement. It will not be defeated without a strategy that recognizes its true nature. In January 2015, we issued a comprehensive strategy to defeat the global jihad movement. It is called the Secure Freedom Strategy and is based on National Security Directive 75, the strategy that President Ronald Reagan used to defeat the global totalitarian threat of his time, the Soviet Union. Like President Reagan's strategy, we lay out a comprehensive plan on how the United States government can be reorganized and focused to understand and defeat the global jihad movement. You can read the Secure Freedom Strategy at securefreedom.org, or you can purchase a copy on Amazon.com. I'm Fred Fleitz.
This is Jenny Thomas. I do video interviews of leaders with the Daily Caller. I had the privilege recently of interviewing Diana West about her extraordinary new book, American Betrayal, The Secret Assault on Our Nation's Character. You can see it at dailycaller.com. American Betrayal reads like a spellbinding historical thriller, but it is also a carefully documented account of how the U.S. government was penetrated by communist agents in the years after President Roosevelt normalized relations with the Soviet Union. Diana West shows how a similar assault is being mounted today by yet another collectivist ideology, the supremacist Islamic doctrine of Sharia. She establishes that while the communists and the Islamists may have very different visions of the world, they have employed the same techniques to defeat America. Please watch my conversation with Diana West about American Betrayal, then check out the other great leaders we profile at dailycaller.com.
Annie Soldier Incorporated was started in August 2003 as a simple family effort to help the soldiers in one Army unit, thus the name. However, due to overwhelming requests, on January 1, 2004, the Annie Soldier effort was expanded so it would include any member of any of the armed services in harm's way. Won't you please help? Find out how by going to www.anysoldier.com today.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
We're back. We're joined by Gordon Chang, a man we have the privilege of speaking with just about every week at this time. He is one of the country's preeminent authorities on East Asia, most especially China, but the Western Pacific and that part of the world in general is something that we turn to him for insights about and advice with respect specifically to American policy. And it's always a privilege to have him with us. He joins us again as a contributor to The Daily Beast, a Forbes.com columnist, a World Affairs Journal blogger, and the author of two terrific books, The Coming Collapse of China and Nuclear Showdown: North Korea Takes on the World. We'll talk about both of those topics with him today. Gordon, welcome back. As always, good to have you.
Thank you so much, Frank.
I'd like to start with, well, I guess a thesis of the coming collapse of China, and that is the demographic time bomb that has been essentially a self-inflicted wound for China now for some time, but it seems as though the chickens are really coming home to roost. Talk a little bit about the piece that you had at World Affairs Journal concerning guns versus canes.
Yeah, I wish that I came up with that phrase, gun versus cranes, but I didn't. This was Howard French, who's also written about demography. And in a recent piece, he talks about the strategic implications of China's tragic demographic profile. And what he says is that Chinese leaders are now starting to understand the consequences of the one-child policy. And because China is going to get smaller, they are starting to see a closing window of opportunity, which is one reason to suggest that they're becoming provocative and belligerent across their periphery, especially in the South China and East China Seas. So clearly, this explains the why, not just then the when, because the when is really important for us as we look at China in a very difficult position.
Well, and the self-inflicted quality of this is that they deliberately restricted Chinese families to one child for many years. They've now eased that somewhat, but there is evidence that it's still a pretty restrictive program. Gordon, is it possible for the Chinese to turn this thing around simply by having two children instead of one permitted?
No, they can't turn it around by a liberalization of the policy. They couldn't even turn it around by scrapping the policy altogether and letting the Chinese people have as many children as they want. Demography is like a big ocean liner. It takes a very long time to change. And right now, there are certain things that are baked into China's demography. So, for instance, we know that India will become the world's most populous society for the first time in 300 years, and maybe for the first time in recorded history. That's supposed to take place in 2022, according to the UN's most recent statistics, but it's probably going to occur earlier than that. And this has the strategic implication because the Chinese have always taken great pride in being the world's biggest tribe. They won't be that way, and they're going to see India as really the comer in Asia, not themselves. So that means that China has to sort of make hay while they can, and that means they're going to be much more provocative and belligerent in the next half decade.
Now, I want to come back to that in a moment, Gordon, but just staying with this internal issue for one more second. Our friend Reggie Littlejohn of the International Women's Movement Without Borders has talked about the degree to which the Chinese government, the Communist Party, is basically obliged, really, to retain this mechanism of control that is incredibly intrusive and really devastating to families, women most especially, arising from the kinds of monitoring of their pregnancies, even their menstrual cycles, I guess. To the extent that this is really at work here, Gordon, how central do you think it is to the nature of the Chinese regime and therefore making its relaxation impossible effectively?
Yeah, the mechanism by which the Chinese government controls the people through its population planning bureaus is absolutely essential. It is the thing that maintains control for the Communist Party. And in some rural places where the party apparatus has withered away, it's really the population people that are the representatives of the central government and the Communist Party. You know, we talk about the scrapping of the one-child policy and going to a two-child policy. Got to remember that in order to have the second child, a couple still needs to get permission. This permission requirement is still there. And matter of fact, there all the other restrictions that have applied are still in place. So this is a real admission, I think, on the part of the central government that they can't change things. And the reason why they can't change it is because the one-child policy is perhaps the biggest governmental mistake in history, short of countries starting wars. And the Communist Party cannot admit that it made a mistake. Every time there's a problem in China, they blame the United States or they blame another country. There's nobody else for them to blame for China's collapsing demography. And that's why it's very, very difficult for them to relax these policies. And they've done this. Their relaxation was much later than everybody thought should occur. That's because the Communist Party cannot.
cannot admit mistakes.
Yeah. And so, Gordon, you have now an effort to seize and in some cases simply manufacture territory, notably in the East and South China Seas. Where you go with this, I guess, is that there's a race for the Chinese to establish their dominion before demography begins to make it more and more difficult for them to pull these kinds of things off. And does that mean that the aggressiveness of the Chinese government could, in fact, translate into conflict if they feel this sort of desperation at the moment?
Yeah, I think conflict is a very high probability, unfortunately. And the reason is right now China is doing things that will inevitably lead to conflict. I'm sure that Chinese generals and admirals don't want to fight a war. As they say, they want to win without fighting. But nonetheless, by flooding the territorial seas of other countries with their fishing boats, Coast Guard cutters, and warships, they are creating situations where eventually the law of averages says that something really horrible is going to go wrong. And you put on top of that some very belligerent attitudes of China's generals and admirals at the most senior levels. And, of course, Xi Jinping, the ruler of the country, is a nationalist himself. You have the country moving in all the wrong directions. And because of that, countries around the region have got to defend themselves. And that means that the United States is going to be involved. So in the last week or so, we have seen so many stories talk about the possibility of war and what a China-U.S. war would look like. These are the signs that something really bad is on the horizon.
Well, this is why we so appreciate your contribution to our recent book, Warning Order, China Prepares for Conflict and Why We Must Do the Same. Let me ask you about one other, speaking of deterrence, manifestation of a dangerous situation, and that is what you've described in a Daily Beast article recently, Gordon, as a growing sense that the South Koreans will respond to North Korean provocations, and perhaps Chinese and others, by acquiring their own nuclear arms.
There is a growing call among ruling party lawmakers for South Korea to develop its own nuclear weapons deterrent. They're saying if there is a fifth North Korean detonation, then South Korea should declare itself free of the non-proliferation treaty and develop its own weapons. Also, you have a lot of South Korean academics who are now talking about a number of things, and many of their proposals are ridiculous, but nonetheless, it shows an indication that the South Korean people, matter of fact, 54% of the South Korean people want their own deterrent. It's a real indication that the South Korean people and the political establishment no longer trust the American deterrent. And that's a real problem because, yes, we do stand behind South Korea. I have no doubt that we would defend them. But nonetheless, that's not what the South Korean people think.
Yeah, unfortunately, it may be what North Korea thinks as well. Gordon Chang, so much more to talk about. We look forward to doing so with you again next week. In the meantime, thank you for your very important contributions at the Daily Beast and World Affairs Journal and Forbes, at least, of course, here at Secure Freedom Radio. Keep it up, my friend. Come back to us soon. I hope the rest of you will do the same again tomorrow. Same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
From the nation's capital, you've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.